You're listening to a podcast of Spurious Morality, Off Target 1, read by Connor, Mansour, Will, and Johnston. And welcome to a podcast of Spurious Morality. My name's Connor, and I'm joined today by Mansour.
Hello.
Will.
Hello.
And Johnston.
Hello.
And we're here today to talk about Target books. So I thought it would be fun to start a little series, and it'll be something we'll hopefully come back to in future, where we're going to review the Target novelizations. We're going to start today with the latest batch, from series one and series two of Bad Wolf Disney Doctor Who, with Shooty Gatwa's 15th Doctor. But we will delve back into the classic backlist in future episodes as well. So I'm really interested to know what everyone's first Target books were back. Maybe some further back than others, possibly. Johnston, what was your first Target book?
I think it was Doctor Who and the Doomsday Weapon, which is Colony in Space. And I'd never seen Colony in Space, so I read Doomsday Weapon, thought it was absolutely brilliant. It was gripping. I had all of these absolutely amazing visuals sort of in my head. And then I saw Colony in Space and yeah.
It exists.
And that it was interesting because that was kind of it was the first time that I kind of realised, oh, hang on a minute, this all looks a bit crap, actually, doesn't it? Like I've just accepted every other Doctor Who story I'd seen previously, because that's what it looked like. But because I had a preconception of Colony in Space going into it, I was actually very disappointed by it. It's also not my favourite ever story, but yeah, it's always going to be that little bit less for me because I read the book first.
And gave it lovely, nice production values in your own head.
I did, yeah. The only other sort of candidate for, I can't remember if it was one of these two. I said Doomsday Weapon because it's a far more interesting story, but the other possibility is the Sontaran Experiment, which again I read before I saw, and it actually expands on the original story a fair bit. It gives Harry, it was written by Ian Marta, so Ian Marta gives his own character a little bit more of an expanded story, and I thought that was quite good. It's another one of those where I perhaps do just about prefer the book to the actual TV original.
Fair enough. Mansour, what was your first Target book?
I'm struggling to know, remember for sure which one was the very first, but like some of the first I remember were things like The Mind Robber, Celestial Toy Maker, maybe the two Dalek Master Plan ones, The Chase. The way I started reading them was I wasn't actually that familiar at all with the TV show, so the Targets were the first sort of main Doctor Who that I was consuming, and it was like interesting because things like The Mind Robber, I remember reading that and then watching it and quite liking the TV version, and then I think The Celestial Toy Maker, I saw that much later, and just but like they're both kind of like stories set in these other realms, but for some reason The Celestial Toy Maker was much more disappointing seeing what it was like on screen, whereas The Mind Robber kind of it's almost fitted with like what I was expecting. So yeah, so I don't know for sure basically, but they were basically my introduction to it before the TV series, which is might be why like I was very into the New Adventures when it went off air and kind of saw that as like the primary ongoing version of the show. But yeah, so short answer, I'm not sure, but it was a collection of different ones that I can remember.
Very nice. Will, what about you? What was your first Target book?
So my first, I actually haven't read very many Targets at all, but when I was about 8 and the show had just come back and I was dipping my feet into a bit of Classic Who as well, our school bookcase had Genesis of the Daleks and Destiny of the Daleks, and I picked up Genesis first. I loved it. It was a really good book. I hadn't seen Genesis at that point, although I would see it very soon afterwards, which was quite interesting because I had the book sort of fresh in my mind. I think probably I preferred the TV episode better overall, but it is a great book. I thought, I think it was Terence Dix wrote that one, really gets Nida across as being, really horrible. That really stuck in my mind. And then seeing it on TV, I was like, oh, I hope they do Nida right. And obviously Peter Miles is fantastic in that. There was one thing which I seem to recall, and maybe I've got this wrong at some point and someone will shout at me, but one thing I was disappointed about the TV episodes was that I believe the explanation of how Davros got his injuries of being a foul bomb is from the novelization. It's not in the TV story. And I vaguely recall watching it and going, oh, that's not in there. What? And so that was one thing that the novelization had over the TV story. And then on the other hand, I did also read Destiny, and Destiny was all right. It's not as good as Genesis, but I didn't actually see Destiny until last year. So a similar sort of situation to Johnston, I suppose, of many, many years separated, and some of the scenes not looking quite right when I did eventually watch them. Although by the time I got round to watching Destiny, I'd already been sort of warned that it was a bit wonky. So it wasn't that much of a surprise.
Fair enough. I think my first one, I remember going in. There's a place in Northern Ireland called Port Stewart, and along the seafront there's a secondhand bookshop. And every time I go into it, I think there's someone who must live around there who is very slowly selling off their Doctor Who collection, because every time I go in, there's another little set of Doctor Who books waiting. The first time I went in, it was a bunch of Target books, and it was sort of around the time when I didn't really know too much about the classic era. So I do remember they had a copy of The Ark in Space, and I think they had the Suntaran Experiment and a couple of John Pertwee's. But I bought Time Lash instead, and that was my first Target book, was Time Lash. I don't actually remember too much about it. I remember reading it and thinking, I actually wish I'd got one of the others instead. I regret not buying the lot while they were there, because the next time I was back, they were gone. And I could have had about twice the Targets that I currently do. It's still there, and I have a grudging fondness for it, because it was my first. So I will do that again at some stage down the line, I think. I'll throw this out to everybody. What is it you think makes a novelization? What is it you think makes a good novelization? What do you look for in these books going into them?
I like to learn something new about the story. So I don't want any big drastic change. Like, I want the adaptation to be pretty faithful. But, I like to find out, a character's motivation or history, something about them that we never actually got in the TV story, or, just those little bits, sort of Adric's a Blake Seven fan, that kind of thing or whatever.
Wee details sort of added into a wee bit more depth or a wee bit more insight, maybe.
Yeah, just like little tidbits, little bits that kind of, they don't have any massive bearing on the story, but it's just a nice thing to know. It's a nice extra little bit that you don't get on TV.
I think I'd agree with that. I definitely don't want it to be an exact one-to-one replica of the TV story. you do want a little bit, some things, you want something either a little bit different or something extra to justify, you know, the same story in a different medium, I think. Mansur, what is it you would look for in a novelization?
I think using the format is always good. I listen to the audiobooks of all of the ones we're going to talk about today, so I've only just learnt that Lux, the printed version, has some like quite unique stuff in the middle of it. But also just like using the medium of prose to do like first person stuff. I remember, I don't know if it was first person, but there was like a lot of backstory added to the Remembrance of the Daleks novelization that like really fleshed out the history of the special weapons Dalek and the Civil War and all of that. So using the medium, adding backstory, and playing with the pace as well, which I think is like really relevant to this most recent Disney era, where like in previous episodes we've talked a lot about how the pace has been a bit breakneck, like, and that you could have done with an extra 5-10 minutes of time. So I think what I'm looking for from a new series adaptation is to like slow things down a little bit and fill in bits that might have been missing or sort of skirted over on TV. So yeah, just using the format and just adding a little bit extra. And I guess it's the opposite of that would be just like transcribing the script. That's probably like the least interesting approach to novelization. So yeah, just doing a bit more than that.
I get that, something a little bit transformative. Will, what do you look for in a novelization?
So, yes, I like what people have said, like, you know, fleshing things out and maybe different perspectives and things like that. I also think that you can sometimes go for bigger swings, because I think personally the sort of the role of a novelization has changed slightly since, you know, back in the day in the classic novelizations, because back then Doctor Who was never repeated. So you saw it once or you missed it, and then all you had was the book, and that was the story to you in general. And so therefore it had to be pretty similar to what had happened on screen with a couple of extra things. But nowadays, this is written for fans and they have the episodes available to them all the time. They've probably seen it a bunch of times. And I think therefore it allows you to, you know, do things a little bit differently. And I think that's something that interests me. So I'll be talking about Lux later and I'll go into that in a bit more depth, but it's been formatted in such a way where it's very clear that James Goss expects that you have seen Lux and that you know what happens in Lux already. And I think that's a pretty good way to do it, because of course it's Doctor Who fans that are reading this. And so, yeah, that's something that interests me.
Okay, I get you. So we'll move on then and we'll start talking about the books that we've read. So we've each focused on one book each from this latest range. We're going to cover Empire of Death, The Robot Revolution, Lux, and The Well. And I'm going to start us off with Empire of Death. So I actually think I can't remember reading a novelization that was more of a one-to-one copy of what was on screen. It's very, very faithful to the TV version. The dialogue is almost identical. And I ended up really looking for places where it had been changed, and there's only really one or two places that it has been changed. The biggest difference between this and the TV stories is that they've gone back and added in some scenes, deleted scenes that were cut from the TV version, either for time or for budget reasons. So there's a little bit at the start with the Doctor and Ruby tracking down different versions of Susan Triad. It's the versions that we see on UNIT screens when the Doctor and Ruby arrive and show Kate and UNIT the different versions of Susan that they have come across. There's a little bit set in America with Albert Einstein. And there's one set with the sort of blue version of her with the horns that was on unit's screen as well. They do add to it as well, though. They go back and add versions of her from previous Doctor Who stories as well. There's one where she's a future kind on Utopia, or you know, one of the rabid humans at the, you know, on the planet in Utopia. I think it was Mal Casero. There's one is from Tranquil Repose. So I like that little detail that they've gone back and added in classic or earlier versions of Susan from places that the TARDIS has landed along the way. So I really, really enjoyed that. They do a little bit, there's a little bit of playing with the format where the prologue happens out of order and it's deliberately tied into what the Doctor says about Susan being his granddaughter, but he hasn't had a child yet. He hasn't had Susan's mother. Susan's mother hasn't been born yet. And it's sort of done the same way, like a prologue can happen before, or the chapter one can come before the prologue sort of thing. So that was quite cool. Prologue sort of goes back and recaps the First Doctor and Susan and sort of explains who she is to the modern audience. So I think that was quite cool. There's at least one scene that's different, and that stuck out to me because it wasn't a copy of what was on screen. It wasn't a deleted scene. It was a version of a scene that was on TV but obviously changed in the filming, which is when the Doctor, Ruby and Mel are they've got the spoon and they're repairing the time window. On screen, that takes place in the Memory TARDIS. In the book, it's in a cave on that planet that they go to and meet the kind woman. So it plays out with the addition of these extra scenes. Most of them are back near the start, where the Doctor and Ruby are going to find the different Susan triads. There's one with the Zarbi that get added, and I'm actually gutted that we didn't get to see the Zarbi on screen again. That would have been quite cool to see in the real version. But other than those, it's very, very faithful to what was on screen. And it, I think it does fall into that mold of, this is more of a memory aid to, you know, remind you of the TV version than it is a book and a novel in its own right. So another detail I really enjoyed was the description of Sutekh's minions. So on screen, they get that sort of, they get the red eyes and the half skull over the tops of their heads. That description's the same in the book, but there's additional stuff like the talk about their hands being more skeletal. And again, this is a detail that's on screen, but there's more attention drawn to it in the book about when their heads turn, their necks crack, or you can hear their bones cracking while they're moving. And it's a really horrifying, it's a really grisly image that keeps getting conjured up. There's a really great line in this where the simplicity of it reminded me of Terence Dix, Through the Ruin of a City, Stalk the Ruin of a Man, just with quite the image it paints with relatively few words. It happens when the Doctor, Ruby and the transformed version of Mel come from 2046 back to Unit Tar to confront Sutekh, and it is the Doctor, Ruby and what remained of Melanie Bush. It's a really great line. It puts over, obviously, that she has been killed, she's dead, but her body's been turned into this, again, really grisly zombie figure. So I really loved that. I thought that was a really great line. I wasn't so keen on the ending. I have to say, I wasn't a fan of the ending on screen either. I think the explanation of how the Doctor defeats Sutekh and undoes the effects of the Death Wave, I don't think that was explained well on screen, and it's still quite woolly here in the novel. And there were things that were more clear than the TV version going through this, like why they needed the spoon to repair the time window. I did think that was better explained in the novel than it was on screen, and I was hoping that how dragging Sutekh through the time vortex undid what happened would be better explained, but it's still very woolly in this. And there's a fairly jarring moment because it draws attention to the fact that Morris Gibbons is a 13-year-old boy. He is very much still a child. And obviously that's obvious on screen as well, but it's the bit where his transport, the guns come out of it and he starts shooting at Sutekh. On screen, it just looks like he's getting into it with the rest of unit and he's firing away really enthusiastically. In the book, the guns come out automatically. He doesn't get any choice in that. And he's terrified. It draws attention to the fact that he's really scared of what's happening around him. And the fact that there's guns coming out of his transport and he's shooting at this thing on the front lines really terrifies him. It's that detail in particular that seems to scare him, as well as the fact that the God of Death has appeared in front of him. But I thought that was quite jarring, certainly for Doctor Who, where it's, you know, a child literally has a gun put into their hands. With, they don't get the choice. Morris doesn't choose to start shooting. It happens automatically. He just has a gun put into his hands and he has to start shooting. It really jarred, I think, and I'm not 100% sure I like the way it was done. But aside from that, I did enjoy it, certainly more than the TV version, and maybe that's just because it's a different medium and I know what I'm going in for. The bit at the end where Ruby meets her mum is done really well. There's a lovely line where Ruby's sort of trying to build up to going over to, you know, approach her mum. And the last line of the paragraph before she actually goes and does it, there's a little bit of a break then, is what if she does this? What if she does? What if she says this? What if she says that? But what if I spoil it? What if it's Ruby wondered, but what if she spoiled it? And then it goes into her meeting her mum. Again, it's a great line, and I think it sells the emotion more in print than I got on screen in any case. So overall, very, very highly faithful to the TV version. I maybe would have liked it to be a little more transformative than just adding in the deleted scenes, but certainly it was worth reading. So the next one in the line then is The Robot Revolution, and that's the one you've read, Mansur.
Yeah, so just for like a bit of context to because we're talking about how novelizations differ from TV, and I think this one was quite interesting in that respect. So like the TV episode we talked about on this podcast before, like I felt was like not bad, but like not great, just like a kind of like solid fun episode. Really liked the character of Belinda, so especially that scene at the end of the episode, so I was really interested going in to see how the novelization might expand on that or give a bit more backstory. And I think I listened to the audiobook for all four of these, and I felt like this was the one out of the four that grabbed that opportunity to add a little bit more that was interesting. So there were quite a few little bits, but the three things that stood out to me was immediately it launches into a lot more backstory for Belinda. And across season two, perhaps because of behind the scenes stuff and things that was changing at a late date, there was this weird absence of Belinda's family apart from seeing them pop up as like the unreal versions in Wishworld. In this novel, you start off with actually getting a lot more detail around Belinda's past, her family, her extended family, So immediately that was like rectifying, I think, an issue with the TV version of her story. Another big thing was Sasha, 55, and again, like for reasons of time, we weren't able to spend that long with her or to understand her relationship with the Doctor, but the book does a great job of just adding a little bit extra to make you care a little bit more about who she is and understand who she is. And there's a really nice little bit of paralleling between Belinda and Sasha as well, where in Belinda's backstory, there's this ceremony or tradition about destiny and predicting, you know, where her life's going to go. And in Belinda's case, it's about traveling. And Sasha, it's not exactly the same, but there's like a very clearly parallel process that goes on there. I think in Sasha's case, it might be the robots or a computer that's like extrapolating what her future is going to be. But I thought that was like a really nice little way to parallel the two characters and kind of say like it's almost by chance that like Sasha was the one who ended up dying and Belinda didn't. And then the last one was Alan, who, like, so with Alan, I think on TV there was this really interesting contrast with Conrad. They both share a lot of traits, and also, like, to some extent with Kid later on as well. But Alan and Conrad both have that kind of that overlap, you know, where that they're in that sort of incel conspiracy theory territory. Alan's more on the incel side and Conrad's at the more conspiracy theory end of things, but clearly those are like things that do overlap. But I thought Conrad was much more subtly drawn over the whole season. He felt like a much more real and therefore more hateable character, whereas Alan, we only see him in one episode. And maybe it was the nature of the story, the robot revolution being a bit lighter, but I thought Alan was much more cartoony in terms of how he was presented on screen. And I think the book does a great job of not completely changing his character, but providing so much backstory about how his relationship with Belinda developed that Alan now feels like a much more real, but still very, very unpleasant and character. And also, like, another thing that fixes is understanding how someone like Belinda would have been in a relationship with him in the first place. And it does an amazing job, I thought, of like giving you her perspective on how things got to that point and like what's going through her head when she sets a boundary and says, no, actually, no, I'm not, I'm going to say no to this and stop this before it goes any further. So yeah, there was probably lots more throughout the book, but like those are the bits that stood out to me just in terms of what it adds to those three characters, Belinda, her family, Sasha, and Alan. And as I said, I listened to the audiobook for all four of these, and this one, along with The Well, I think was one of my favourite readings. Like none of them were particularly bad. They were all good, competent readings. But yeah, Rada Sesu reading this one, and then like I said, the last one, the Well, that I think that was read really nicely as well. But it adds a lot because this is introducing Belinda as a character, so to have the actor who played her on screen reading the audiobook, that worked really well for me as well. So yeah, I really enjoyed this one, and I think this like completely achieved that goal or mission of adding to the TV episode, not just adding, like not just sort of shoving in deleted scenes, but adding depth to it and making you go back and see the TV version differently the next time you watch it. So yeah, really, really enjoyed this one and would absolutely recommend it, with the caveat that I still really dislike the way Belinda's story finishes on screen. So if they ever get to novelizing Wishworld and the Reality War, I'd be really curious to see what they might be able to do to put a new spin on the way her story ends up. But yeah.
I'd be really interested to see whether we would get the version that was on screen or something closer to the original pre-reshoots version of the Reality War.
Yeah. Or a combination, like maybe where reality gets rewritten and you see the different versions.
Yeah, I'd really like to read that. Will, you've been reading Lux. What did you think?
I have been reading Lux. So Lux was one of my favourite episodes of the most recent series. So that was the one I sort of gravitated towards. And overall, I enjoyed it. I think James Goss was a good choice. And he creates a novelization that I think is quite playful, I suppose, in keeping with the tone of the episode itself, mostly. So one point I will mention, because Mansour has already mentioned that there are bits in the books where there's like screenshots of the episodes, and I think there's a bit where there's like screenshots of the actual script they would use for a deleted scene that ends up in the book. Except that I also listen to the audiobook. So sadly, I won't be able to comment much on that. But just to note that that is something that they did, which is quite a nice, interesting touch. On the audiobook front, I'll say that Dan Starkey does do an excellent Mr. Ringerding. So that's a plus on that side. So with the book itself, it is actually mostly pretty faithful to the episode, with maybe one sort of bigger structural change that I'll go into in a minute. So we've got a little bit more backstory about Belinda, about her parents, not as much as in Robot Revolution, just a little touch early on, you know, when they're still in the TARDIS, she talks a little bit about her parents, and I think they're in a skiffle band and her dad's bad at karaoke and things like this. Just small touches there, which I don't recall being in the original episode. We also get a little bit of extra backstory about Mr. Ringerding, or Lux in general. Which is quite nice. I was at first not sure about its placement, because this sort of chapter that goes into why Lux is doing what he's doing and things like that comes basically at the climax. So as he's absorbing all this regeneration energy and, you know, becoming this big threat, the book literally goes, okay, let's step back and talk about, you know, how Lux came here and things like this. And I thought, is this the best place? But then I wouldn't know where to put it else. So I suppose so. And so that was an interesting aspect. And on that front, the episode, the book goes a bit more into some of the thematic stuff that was, you know, pointed out in the episode, which goes into a bit more depth here. So this idea of, this is something that comes up in the cold open, which has been extended quite a lot, not in terms of what actually happens. It's pretty faithful, but just the prose. And we really get into a lot of people's heads. We get into Reginald Pye's head, and we get into the heads of some of the cinema goers and things like this. And we, Reginald himself thinks about light both as a source of hope, but also as a source of destruction and, you know, light and dark and things like this. And I think, definitely things that were in the episode that has been explored more in the book, which is always something that you want. The main change that this book makes, and something that James Goss had a lot of fun with, is with the fans. So obviously in the episode, it is a big twist that halfway through, the Doctor and Belinda break out of the TV and meet a bunch of Doctor Who fans. But as I was saying earlier, anyone reading Lux already knows that's going to happen, so it is not kept as a twist here. In fact, the book opens with the fans, and they act as a sort of framing device. There's a bit where, a bit into the book, they actually stop and have a tea break and think about, you know, what's happened so far. And it's here that Goss has the most fun, where he can sort of add in a load of classic references, and he has them say, one of them says that, like, there's someone on a forum said that something really surprising is going to happen halfway through, which of course is very funny, with given that it's going to be the Doctor falling out of the TV. And yeah, just a few sort of lighthearted jabs at both fandom and the show itself. A particularly funny one is that one of the fans, I think they're called Hassan, Lizzie and Robin, I think it's Hassan, thinks that everything is the Rani. Thinks that the Rani's going to show up at any moment, which is obviously very appropriate here. But especially funny that apparently James Goss has said that when he wrote that, he had not been told that the Rani was coming back. So that is quite funny. And then you just get little nods, like one of Hassan keeps talking about the Rani, so they suggest they watch one of Rani's classic stories, and he pulls a bit of a face. Just a little bit of a knock at Pip and Jane there, but I think they'll manage. And yeah, that's, I think there's a lot of fun to be had there, and it really fleshes out those characters more. It does a sort of a nice touch that the episode itself does. You might recall they say, like, we're the kind of characters that don't have surnames, but then if you actually watch the credits, they have surnames. It does a similar thing in this where they are always just described by their first name until the final chapter where they are described with surnames. And certainly it's those additions really there where the book is the most fleshed out. The dialogue is generally, anything that is on screen is generally pretty similar to what happens. One thing I actually would have changed is that now that they've really fleshed out these fans, there is no way that all of them's favourite story is Blink. I mean, Doctor Who fans cannot agree on anything. Robin's favourite story is definitely something like Natural History of Fear, but, you know, fine, you know, we can keep it. yeah, that was the sort of the main change, as opposed to when we actually get into the story, it's a pretty faithful retelling, with one exception, which is that deleted scene I mentioned, which I assume was cut for budget, but it's quite a clever little bit where they started getting chased by a plane, North by Northwest style, and they are attempting to break out of the frame, similar to the cartoon bit, but they can't because they're in a wide shot, which is just a very amusing idea that the book actually does manage to convey, given that obviously it's a very visual thing. And so eventually Belinda manages to bring attention to herself, which causes a close-up so that she can then drag the frame down, which is, it's communicated very well. Kind of upsetting that we didn't get that, because it sounds like quite a fun bit, if it had been in the original episode. So yeah, overall, I found it to be just quite a fun book. Obviously, very fanish. I think it's really... For me, I think that if you're going to be sort of fanish and self-indulgent, the Target novelizations are probably the best place to do it. Because there's also references to not forgetting to subscribe to the official Doctor Who YouTube channel, and a reference to this novelization, where as they're watching the episode, they note that there's going to be a novelization from the guy who wrote The Giggle, which one of the fans says was all right, they guess, and things like that. So, yeah, basically a pretty faithful adaptation of Lux, but with James Goss having a lot of fun on top of it, with these very meta aspects that the episode was known for. I think that's everything. That's the main gist.
It sounds very similar to what he did with The Giggle, where he had the toy maker was sort of, it was told in the first person from the toy maker's point of view, and there's a bit where he stops just after Shudi Gatwa arrives. After the bi-generation, and I was like, okay, I'm going to stop now and go and read the fan fiction. so I love those wee details. It's I think Goss has a really funny style, and I like the irreverent comedy that he's put into his Target book so far. So I think Lux might move its way up to the top of my reading list now.
Yeah, it is quite funny on that point, because I think. In his books, Goss is known for this very irreverent tone and this sort of lighthearted comedy sort of stylings, and which is quite amusing, because literally the Doctor, well, the Hooniverse story I listened to before Lux was The Hope, which is by James Goss and very much not a comedic lighthearted. It's quite the change from one to the other. That is an oppressive story. Yeah, he does. Yeah, and he has a lot. He has a lot of tricks, but for his books, he's more known as this lighthearted figure. And then you listen to some of his torturings, and you're like, Jesus, James.
I've done, I really, I haven't done it for a long time, but I really enjoyed his Target version of City of Death, which I think was a sort of abridged version of his. He had done a longer novelization of it before, and I think the Target one's an abridged version. But I remember that comedy being there, but it's more in the Adams style. It's in the turn of phrase. It's maybe not so in your face as the Luck sounds and as the giggle was. But it's very much present there as well, and I really hope we get some more targets from him in future. Johnston, you're going to finish us off then with The Well. What did you think?
So I'm going to kind of preface this by saying that I really liked the episode The Well, and I did really like this novel, or novelization, I should say, because I feel like I'm going to be mean here. Maybe I'm not, but bear with. So, The Well, great episode. Very, very tense. Lots of slow-paced, tense, dialogue-heavy scenes. Not an awful lot going on visually, because that's kind of the nature of the beast, literally, of the monster. So, I don't think that it... the novelization had a lot to go on. And I honestly think that maybe there was a bit of an issue filling the word count with this one. It's quite short. I'm not sure how many pages it is. I've listened to it. And the audiobook was pretty much bang on 3 hours, which compared to other targets I've listened to, I've probably listened to about 20 others, I would guess. It's by far the shortest. It's the shortest by a good half an hour, at the very least. And I genuinely think it's because there's not a lot to adapt. Not much happens in The Well. It's not about story and events so much. It is about the tension, the pace, the, you know, all that kind of thing. It takes a lot of sidesteps, is basically what I'm saying here. The book takes a lot of sidesteps. It goes in varying directions. It references other things. I really like the start, though. The prologue is kind of the story so far from the perspective of the creature. So it kind of references what went on in Midnight based on how the creature saw things. You know, it remembers the Doctor. It's determined that one day it will get revenge on the Doctor. That's your prologue. It's kind of short and sweet. I really like it, though. It's you know, I was talking earlier about something that you will never get in a TV episode. That's it. Just a little bit from the perspective of the monster from Midnight and The Well. And it works really well. But then we go into the main story and we spend what felt like a long time doing the who is the Doctor, who is Belinda, what is the TARDIS, you know, explaining the basics, which, yeah, okay, a lot of other targets kind of filled out the word count by doing that. I can sympathise. But this seems to go into a lot of detail. It takes quite a while for the Doctor and Belinda to actually get out of the TARDIS. And nothing particularly happens that we didn't see on screen. It's the whole stuff about, you know, going to the world wardrobe, girl, you're starting to enjoy this, all that kind of thing. It's all there, recreated pretty faithfully. Everything in the episode is recreated very, very faithfully. So we've a lot of very sort of description heavy material, and it's purely, I think it's purely to mask the fact that there's not an awful lot of story there. Again, not a criticism. The Well was a great episode, and this is a good adaptation of that. One sort of little sidestep that it takes that I did quite like is every time one of the soldiers becomes significant, we kind of go into a little bit of a profile about them. So it's, you know, this soldier here, this age, from this place, they're involved with these battles. Here is their military record. They are likely to be promoted, not likely to be promoted for this reason, all that kind of thing. And again, it's really good. It's extra just little bits about these characters. But the problem is, we've never heard of any of these battles before. It's literally just like, oh yes, served in the Battle of Zog and was the only survivor from their battalion. It doesn't really mean anything. It's literally just a lot of, it's a lot of words. And, you know, it's something that Russell T. Davies was really, really good at first time round, you know, referencing things like the Nightmare Child and sort of all of this. And it just doesn't work as effectively here. But I like it. I like it as a just something that's scattered throughout the book. It just gives us a little bit more about these sort of military characters. And it is very easy. And certainly on screen, it kind of feels like they are just like soldier number two, who's second from the left. So we just get a bit more about them. And that's nice. We get a pretty much full flashback to Midnight. So Donna's in it, the 10th Doctor's in it, but it's basically just the conversation that they have in the pre-title sequence of Midnight. You know, the Doctor telling Donna, oh, come on, it'll be a lot of fun, and Donna going, no, I'm sunbathing. So again, we're not getting anything new here. We're just filling a few pages by rehashing the first couple of minutes of Midnight. It does a little bit to flesh out Belinda. Not loads. It sounds like Robot Revolution does a far better job, judging by what Mansour said. But it's definitely there. We do get little bits about Belinda, and we get quite a bit of stuff from her perspective and how she's feeling and that kind of thing. So we learn a little bit more about her. And again, it talks about her parents, although that was covered in previous books for the sounds of it. Again, it doesn't really have any bearing on the story. It really does feel like we're just trying to reach a word count here. Lots of Mavity. Mavity gets referenced so much, which is great, but I kind of... The TV show, books, everything, I'm just ready for the punchline now. We've got the joke. It's all very good. Can we have the punchline now? Can it lead somewhere? Can it be significant or not? Just let's resolve that one. So yeah, I like I say, I didn't dislike this. It's a very, very good adaptation of a very, very good episode. I just don't think the episode lends itself particularly well to this kind of adaptation. It's not a sort of epic, rip-roaring story. It is quite slow-paced, certainly for the most part. It does certain bits really well. It does the bits that the episode does really well. So, sort of, you know, characters being thrown around. We get some pretty nasty descriptions about every bone in their body being snapped when they're thrown around, and that's what kills them. We genuinely get the terror of Alice, you know, how horrible it's been for her to be locked there for a couple of weeks. And the reveal that it's Midnight is done pretty much as it is on screen. It kind of cuts between the Doctor and Belinda and the various conversations that they're having. Again, really done, really well done. We do get the tension. It is all there. But I'm always going to come back to the fact that it just sort of, it kind of lacks focus because it doesn't have all that much of a story to tell. Not because it's a bad story, it's just that kind of episode that it's adapting.
I get the impression that, it's a thriller on screen, a suspense thriller on screen. And it sounds, I think a lot of that is in how that sort of television is made. You know, the style of filming, the sets, the performances. I can see it being difficult to translate that into a novel without too much going on event-wise to spice things up for the prose. I would like to read it because I really enjoy the TV version as well. I hope to read all of these at some point. But I fully get what you say about it being a difficult one to adapt into a book. So that brings us to the end. hopefully we'll come back and do some more of these. I really want to delve back into the classic backlist and see how some of my favorite TV stories, because I own quite a few Target books. I haven't actually read very many. I would love to see how some of my favorite TV stories work as novels. I'm really interested to do stuff like The Romans and Day of the Doctor, where the formats are sort of switched up and there's a lot going on with the style of the book, The Romans in particular, being sort of made up from like different historical documents. So thank you all very, very much for joining this, and thank you all for listening. I'll say goodbye to Johnston.
Goodbye.
To Mansur.
Goodbye.
To Will.
Goodbye.
And it's a good night from me as well. Thank you all for listening. We'll hopefully be back for some more spodcasting soon. Goodbye.